GLP-1 receptor agonists are about the first class that allows a significant reduction in body weight without risking serious adverse events. It's no longer a problem for long-term use. So with some members of this class, you can promise a patient that on average, they will lose like 10, maybe 15% of their original body weight, which is very, very meaningful in terms of reducing some risks.
Welcome to the GLP-1 Podcast Show, a monthly podcast where you'll find cutting-edge insights and all that's working in the world of metabolic health and obesity care. Our aspiration is to be the first place you are going to go to find out what's happening, the latest updates, and the latest research in GLP-1 science and clinical practice.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the GLP-1 podcast show hosted by Wisenetics. I'm Marisha Moyes, a clinical researcher from McGill University. And today I'm joined here by Professor Michael Nolk, head of clinical research at the Diabetes Division of St. Joseph Hospital in Bochum, Germany. Dr. Nolk is an internationally recognized for his pioneering work on incretin hormones, especially GLP-1 and GIP, and their role in type 2 diabetes. His studies were pivotal in demonstrating the therapeutic potential of GLP-1s, and he has contributed to the development of both GLP-1 receptor agonists and DPP-4 inhibitors. Over his career, he has published more than 250 original articles, with his work cited over 80,000 times. He has received numerous awards, including the Paul Langerhans Medal and the Claude Bernard Medal. It's truly an honor to have him here today. Dr. Nolk, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So let's start at the beginning. You're often credited with discovering the incretin effect. So can you take us back to those early studies and describe what it was like to realize these gut hormones were central to glucose regulation?
Well, the incretin effect is an experimental paradigm where you do two experiments. One experiment is providing oral glucose to be swallowed and digested and absorbed. And this way it reaches the pancreas, but at the same time, while being absorbed from the gut, these incretin hormones that you already mentioned are released. And incretin hormones are hormones from the gut, typically stimulated by nutrients, sensing the absorption process and telling the pancreas, be prepared, a meal is being digested and absorbed. You should now respond quickly and release a lot of insulin. And therefore, when you do such an experiment with an oral glucose load, you reach much higher insulin concentrations and overall insulin secretion rates as compared to the same experiment done with intravenous glucose. And so some previous studies from the 1960s, when the insulin radioimmunoassay was discovered and described, it was possible to do those experiments, had already shown that absorbed nutrients, enteral administration gives you more insulin than intravenous glucose. But with the advancement in science, we were able to really copy the glucose curves originating from oral glucose loads so that we could say glycemic stimulus under both conditions is really identical, and still you only have like a third of the insulin response with intravenous glucose. And the explanation is there is no incretin release. Incretins are only released from the gut when there is nutrients within the gut lumen being absorbed, and not if you let the glucose enter the bloodstream bypassing the gut.
Wisenetics turns podcast airtime into brand authority. We don't sell ads, we elevate voices. If you're ready to boost your authority in the industry, access wisenetics.com and speak with a brand authority specialist. Let's transform expertise into influence, starting now.
Did you ever imagine this early work would lead to this whole therapeutic class of drugs?
This was not intended to show any therapeutic potential of anything. It was just a physiological study showing this mechanism, the mechanism of incretin-induced insulin secretion and how much it matters in healthy subjects. However, we soon did experiments in patients with type 2 diabetes and expected, because there were previous studies indicating that the incretin effect was reduced. There was less influence of incretins on insulin secretion in patients with type 2 diabetes. So in some of them, we couldn't see any incretin effect. So that means oral glucose was as active as intravenous glucose in stimulating insulin. And that then prompted more experiments regarding the individual incretin hormones. You already mentioned them, GLP-1 and GIP. In fact, GIP was discovered like a decade earlier than GLP-1. And it's a very potent incretin hormone in healthy subjects. But what we learned by doing these experiments is that it doesn't really work in subjects with type 2 diabetes. So since they were no longer able to respond to GIP, it didn't matter whether you gave the glucose through the oral route or the intravenous route, the insulin response was more or less the same.
So these early studies really set the stage for everything we have today. So let's fast forward a little bit. How did these discoveries translate into the first GLP-1 therapies?
As I said, the order of discovery was GIP first and then GLP-1. And the GIP story was we learned, yes, it works nicely in healthy animals and humans, but not in the state of diabetes mellitus. So these were exactly the same examinations that were done a decade later with GLP-1. And there, to everyone's surprise, GLP-1 was able to stimulate insulin secretion in patients with type 2 diabetes. And it also, in addition, suppressed glucagon and it decelerated gastric emptying. And these three mechanisms are responsible for the fact that, yes, by stimulating GLP-1 receptors, you can lower glucose and you can have therapeutic effects. At that time, nobody knew that you can also reduce body weight. That was described a few years later. But this as a package is very attractive for treating patients with type 2 diabetes because we now know it is as effective as insulin therapy for type 2 diabetes, but with almost no risk for hypoglycemia and with the added benefit of some weight loss that you get through inhibiting appetite and energy intake.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned that GIP was discovered before GLP-1 and then it didn't work. And now it's kind of been repurposed with tirzepatide and obesity use. So you were also involved in TPP4 inhibitor development. So how do you compare their role to GLP-1 receptor agonists today?
When GLP-1 and its glucose lowering effects were discovered, people were also aware of the fact, almost at the same time, that both incretin hormones are degraded and inactivated by a protease, which is DPP4, dipeptidyl peptidase number 4. And that is almost everywhere in the body, in the gut, in the blood, in tissues. And so wherever something like GLP-1 appears, it is inactivated and degraded by DPP4. And since everyone was now aware that GLP-1 is able to lower glucose, the question was, can the same thing be achieved by inhibiting this protease so that less GLP-1 is degraded and the same amount secreted is suddenly sufficient to lower glucose in patients with type 2 diabetes. And the answer was yes. So if you want to know details, this therapy just doubled the intact levels of GLP-1, undegraded GLP-1, which is the biologically active form. And just doubling the concentration versus non-DPP-4 inhibitor-treated patients had some meaningful effect on glucose. And still, the GLP-1 receptor agonists, the injectable drugs, they reached much higher concentrations and were more effective. And so there was, it was a nice story that you could use GLP-1, but without administering anything like GLP-1, but just by influencing the process of degradation and inactivation. So for a while, DPP-4 inhibitors were rather popular because they had very little side effects. Now that we know that they do not change cardiovascular risk like GLP-1 receptor agonists do and SGLT2 inhibitors do, they are no longer the prime interest for diabetologists to use. So now I think they're good drugs to treat elderly people who cannot tolerate any adverse effects of medications, but the therapeutic effect, the effect size, how much you reduce HbA1c and glucose is much less than we have seen with GLP-1 receptor agonists.
So now that GLP-1s are well established as therapies, let's talk a little bit about their impact beyond glucose control. So you kind of alluded a little bit to the cardiovascular benefit of GLP-1s, but what about other real world benefits, like for the kidneys, for obesity?
It has been very, very difficult to find drugs that reduce body weight in those who are obese and who should lose some of their pounds and kilograms in order to be healthier, associated with a lower risk for especially cardiovascular events like myocardial infarction and stroke. Many things have been tried, usually effective weight-lowering drugs had serious side effects that prevented their widespread use. And GLP-1 receptor agonists are about the first class that allows a significant reduction in body weight without risking serious adverse events. They have their usually transient nausea and maybe vomiting, but usually that is only during the initial period and you get accustomed to it and it's no longer a problem for long-term use. And so with some members of this class, you can promise a patient that on average they will lose like 10, maybe 15% of their original body weight, which is very, very meaningful in terms of reducing some risks. We also have learned in this year and maybe last year that you can address specific comorbidities associated with obesity. So there is obesity is very much associated with diabetes. So you can prevent diabetes in those who have obesity and pre-diabetes but no manifest diabetes. You can have very positive results in patients who have a certain form of heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, which is also typically associated with obesity. You can reduce symptoms of osteoarthritis of the knee, of obstructive sleep apnea syndrome, and the like, of fatty liver disease associated with obesity leading to liver fibrosis, likely to progress to cirrhosis and maybe to hepatocellular carcinomas. So for all these entities, we have very good therapeutic studies that in patients who have those problems, you can help them significantly. But as you also mentioned, many patients with diabetes, and I think we mostly know it about those, have a risk to develop chronic kidney disease, eventually leading to the need for dialysis or transplantation of a kidney. And GLP-1 receptor agonists have shown to slow down the process of reduced filtration over the years. So the kidneys slowly lose their function, especially in patients with diabetes. It happens without diabetes as well. And so if you start this kind of treatment early enough, it is very likely that you can at least postpone the point where the terminal phase of kidney disease begins, when you need dialysis or other treatments to save the lives of these people.
This is all really exciting stuff. I'm wondering if you can comment on how many of these benefits are downstream effects of the weight loss directly, or if there are other mechanisms of GLP-1s at play here, because I know GLP receptors are found all over the body and they do have other actions beyond just, you know, influencing appetite suppression and all that stuff like that.
Well, historically, they were made to reduce glucose. So because that was our view on treating diabetes, and we used a lot of insulin for that purpose. And our hope always has been that if you keep the glucose low in patients with diabetes, some of the complications will not appear or be delayed in time. But when the first cardiovascular studies were performed, people tried to pinpoint the mechanism that is behind the reduction in risk to have myocardial infarction and stroke and other vascular complications and mortality associated with such events. And so naively, you may have hoped that what you find is the reduction in blood pressure and in body weight the improvement in your risk profile is what does the job, but that doesn't appear to be the case. So there were some studies indicating that a drug that is better in reducing HbA1c is also better in reducing cardiovascular events, but this may be a misleading conclusion, because what does this show? If a drug is good in reducing HbA1c, it's good at stimulating GLP-1 receptors, but it may not be the same GLP-1 receptors that are responsible for the reduction in cardiovascular risk. It's just target engagement that is good for both outcomes. And I'm convinced that there are multiple steps in the process of atherogenesis. So generation and growth of atherosclerotic plaques, and in preventing them rupturing, which gives rise to acute events like acute myocardial infarction, is what explains the cardiovascular benefits. So it's happening within the blood vessel, and the process of atherogenesis is quite complicated. So there are monocytes involved entering the intima layer of the vessels, turning into macrophages and later into foam cells, and then they undergo necrosis and form the content of atherosclerotic plaques. But it's also endothelial function, vasodilation, smooth muscle function and proliferation, cytokines that influence the whole process, some proteases, again, so-called matrix metalloproteinases that digest collagen. And if they do so, the plaque is more likely to rupture, and you can suppress the function of these metalloproteinases and in order to prevent rupturing of the plaques. So most likely it is not the well-known old cardiovascular risk factors, but something that GLP-1 does on these cells within the blood vessels.
Yeah, I believe it was the SELECT trial that showed there was reduction in MACE even in patients that didn't have significant weight loss. So I was really interested in seeing, you know, how many, what amount of this benefits were mediated by weight loss versus other mechanisms. So it's really, honestly, it's really interesting to see like all these pleiotropic effects that we didn't even anticipate. You know, when we first started looking at these drugs for diabetes management, now we have established all these other indications that,
so, you know. I see the SELECT study as indicating you don't need diabetes and you don't need major reduction in blood glucose and HbA1c because the SELECT population was non-diabetic. They had obesity and there was a reduction in body weight. But what you could learn from this is you don't have to see the glucose lowering effects in order to observe the cardiovascular risk reduction.
I think I may be referring
also to... it is important to notice these were not just obese subjects. They had established cardiovascular disease to begin with. That means this process of atherogenesis had already led to some damage in these patients. So it's another example that very much speaks in favor of this mechanism acting on various processes. I think we have counted like 13 different steps of atherogenesis where well-documented effects of GLP-1 have been described.
Yeah, I think I was talking about a post-hoc analysis of the SELECT that had like a separate analysis of patients that didn't lose as much weight but still had these MACE reduction. So it seems like we've come a really long way already, but the field is still advancing very fast. We're seeing dual and triple agonists like tirzepatide and retatrutide. I know you kind of talked a little bit about GIP earlier in our talk, but how do you see these new drugs fitting into the treatment landscape?
You know, the treatment of obesity aims at reducing significant amounts of body weight. And what we call significant is starting at like 5% reduction in body weight, and you have some medical benefits of reaching 5% weight reduction, but for other complications, you need like 10, 15, 20% weight reduction. 15%, for example, if you have type 2 diabetes, you can get remission from this diabetes. It's no longer measurable once you have lost 15% of your body weight in the vast majority of patients. And so thinking of the adverse consequences of obesity, which are different in various people, you want to have drugs that allow weight reduction by 20, maybe 25%. And if you want to compete with bariatric surgery, there you can achieve 30, 35%. And some people really need this. So there is a very active time in drug development. And as you mentioned, the idea now is, among other approaches, that you try to develop medications also based on peptide hormones like the incretin hormones, but a single drug is able to address not only one mechanism, but two or three. And I have heard there are developments aiming at four mechanisms at the same time expressed in the same peptide. Whether they will be superior, we will see. But when you look at animal experiments and at early stage clinical trials, some of these dual or triple agents promise greater effect sizes for weight reduction. Some are also a little bit better for reducing HbA1c, so for diabetes treatment. And I think it's fair to make a prognosis that probably like 5 years from now, there will be a few drugs that will on average reduce body weight by 25% or so. However, everyone is competing to give you the best body weight reduction. Some are very bold and use high doses, and at least the early stage studies with some of these agents show a lot of so-called GI side effects, so nausea and vomiting in up to 90% of the subjects. So I think these programs will have to work hard to find a way to reduce the burden of adverse events, because that will not be universally acceptable to the potential patients. And there will be, that is my prediction, a competition not only for larger effect sizes, but also for better tolerability.
So, Professor Nock, thank you so much for sharing your insights and for walking us through both the history and the future of GLP-1 therapies. It was really, really inspiring to hear someone from whose work has really shaped, you know, modern diabetes and obesity care. And we would also really like to thank listeners for tuning into the GLP-1 podcast show. If you found this episode valuable, please like, comment, and share. We'd love to hear your thoughts and questions. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss any future conversations with leaders in the field. Until next time, thank you so much for listening.
My pleasure.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with Elite Remote Talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.